explaining how Judaism actually fits into all of this. So, firstly, thank you everyone for coming out. Middle of a busy week, I'm sure. And thank you very much to the Bressmans for hosting, and a special happy birthday to the hostess. So, just to do a quick recap and a sort of a summary of what I like to think of as the journey we've gone on so far, the journey of faith and emunah, which we began with looking at four different angles as to how a person has a sort of intuitive, simple, youthful faith that just comes from a basic place within themselves, either through something that is implanted in us from God, that we just have a natural capacity to feel a pull towards something beyond the world, or it's through looking at nature and feeling that there's clearly something beyond the physical world that meets the eye. It's getting wrapped up and caught up in that beauty, in that grand vision, and feeling the presence of God. Or the third angle we looked at was, I think this was actually the second, but out of order, the third angle we looked at was sort of divine encounters through experiencing things that just don't seem to make perfect sense and seem too coincidental or too perfect or just is worked out too neatly, and there seems to be some sort of hand of God involved in all the stories we hear. And the fourth angle we looked at this basic sort of faith was that we seek meaning, that the human being is a meaning-seeking being, and that through that search and that crave and that drive and deep desire for meaning, we come to believe in a God, in God that satiates that need, that comes and fills that void of yearning for meaning. And then sort of we looked at if we have that basic, youthful, maybe naive part of ourselves that has that craving for God, that has that belief in God, that intuitive, natural pull towards God, so then what happens to it? And what we suggested was that as we grow up, as we become older, more maybe sophisticated, more thinking, more rational, more critical thinking people, so we start questioning and we start operating from a space within our minds that thinks in a more boxy maybe type of way, in a more do well in school type of way, which is more linear, more critical, more straight thinking, which doesn't allow for those sort of natural intuitions and those capacities within ourselves to really express themselves. And that can sort of cramp our style, can sort of get in the way, and like we spoke about, it's like the infiltrating down into this faith. Like we have this faith, and all of a sudden as we grow up, we have like these troops of our minds infiltrating into this faith and taking it over and getting in the way. And what we spoke about last time was trying to realize the space and the value that part of our mind should hold, because it's obviously an essential part of our being, an essential part of life, that place of questions and that place of critical rational thinking, but to realize that it shouldn't take up the full real estate of our personalities. It shouldn't be the entirety of who we are. We should also give voice and give expression to the other parts of ourselves that have this pull towards these other types of experiences. Maybe you could call them more artsy, more experiential, more emotional, more holistic thinking types of experiences. So then, with that, we were sort of opened up to the possibility of recapturing and rediscovering that simple, natural, intuitive pull towards faith. So that's all, I think, at least awesome and beautiful. But then the question is, so if we have that faith and that pull towards God, and let's say, yeah, let's say we can recapture that inspiration, let's say we can create that space within ourselves to put the questions, put the skepticism, put the cynicism aside, check it, and now we have this open, emotional, inspirational part of ourselves that's coming to the fore. But so, okay, so what does that have to do with what we know as Judaism? What does that have to do with mitzvos? What does that have to do with halacha? What does that have to do with all the technicalities and all the things that seem to very often be pretty annoying? And, you know, if you remember the analogy we started off with in the very, very beginning of that guy schlepping up the suitcases and he's breaking his back and bending over and he ends up realizing he's schlepping the wrong suitcases. So, you know, very often we feel like in Judaism it's just like this huge burden on our backs that we're schlepping. It's like annoying. Did we do this right? Did we do this wrong? Did I make sure this was okay? Did I buy the right marinara sauce at the supermarket last week? The answer was no, and it wasn't kosher. So it gets very technical and annoying. Really, really. Really, really good. So this is going on YU Torah. So how does all that stuff fit into this really inspirational and sort of like, you know, happy, positive type of picture? So that's what I want to talk about tonight, and hopefully it's just the beginning. It's just a tiny little start of how to actually go through what Judaism is trying to do, but I hope it can at least present you with a lens to look through at all the details afterwards. We're not going to really get into details of specific mitzvahs, but it'll sort of be a framework for how to try and then process mitzvahs, you know, on your own and in coming opportunities to learn together, hopefully, God willing. So what I want to do is I want to start with actually taking a step back and going back to the point that we spoke about and opening it up a little bit more of what does it mean to encounter God in this world? What does it mean when we say you experience God, you feel God's presence in beauty, in art, in the natural world, in a craving for meaning, in connection, in relationships? What does that mean? Where does that come from? And all, this all starts with I think we have to go back to understanding on a very basic level, what are the spheros, the spherot? Okay, as maybe people have heard that term before, a Kabbalistic term. And I want to look at what are they. It's a huge topic, which is well beyond my capacity to understand for myself and for sure give over. But just to understand a tiny basic understanding of what that means will open this up for us a little bit. So if you look at part source one on the sheets, Rabbi Arya Kaplan, in a book called Inner Space, gives us a basic understanding, a basic conception of what these spheros are. And if you have no idea what I'm referring to, don't worry. Hopefully it'll become a little bit clearer in a second. So Rabbi Kaplan writes as follows. God is an absolute unity in every possible respect. We see God as a simple unity, absolutely simple and absolutely one. There is no element of form, structure, or plurality in him whatsoever. According to the Kabbalists, God's simple essence is so powerful that it must be hidden in creation. It must be hidden if creation is to exist at all. The question, therefore, is, how can a many exist? Okay, so here's what he's trying to say. What he's trying to say is the following. God, we know he says, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hashem is one. We don't just mean that God is one, there's not two gods. We mean that God is one. He's a pure, simple entity. There's no parts. It's not composite. It's not a conglomerate of parts. God doesn't have separate aspects to him. God is just a pure oneness. It's a unique, singular being of one simple entity. Okay, Hashem Echad. Hashem is one. Hashem is purely one. It's not like you take, you know, a cookie has separate parts, you put it together, okay? Or you could take it into separate parts. God is just a oneness that can't be divided into separate parts. There's no separateness to identify. And the question here by Kaplan is raising is that if we say, which the Kabbalists, that's what he's quoting here, that in order for this world to exist, it only exists by way of God's hiddenness inside of it, meaning it is God's presence in this world that is the vitality of the world. It's God's presence, God's being itself, which is underlying in a hidden way the world itself. The world, the word olam in Hebrew means word. It means world. It actually also is the word helem, which means hiddenness. This world is the mask of God's presence. But in this world is God. And on a certain level, this world actually is just a part of God. In order for the world to exist, it has to be from God's giving it vitality. So then the question is, this world, which clearly is a world of multiplicity, this world is parts. We are each independent beings. This table is separate from the chair. This house is separate from the house next to it. There's distinctions, there's multiplicity, there's parts, there's fragments. So how did a God, which is simply one, purely one, end up being a world of multiplicity? How is that possible? How could a God, which is purely one, create, and not just create, but sort of live in and give way to a world, which is a world of complete multiplicity? And the answer to this, Ray Kaplan writes, is through the spheros. And if you look at the second paragraph here, the spheros act variously as filters, garments or vessels for the light of Ein Sof that fills them. The term sphera itself derives or is related to the Hebrew saper, meaning to express or communicate, and sapir, which means sapphire, brilliance, or luminary. It is also related to safar, meaning number, sifar, boundary, and sefer, book. These are all words that relate to the word sphera. In essence, all of these are related concepts and point to the spheros as having two basic functions. First, the spherot are orot, lights, or luminaries that serve to reveal and express God's greatness. Secondly, They are kelim, vessels, that limit and delineate God's infinite light, bringing it into the finite realm of number and boundary. Okay, so what did he just say? The svirot are sort of this lens. It's very hard to define, so I'm not going to try and do a good job. I'm just going to be purposely ambiguous. But the svirot are sort of this intermediary existence that either emanated from God, was created by God, was revealed by God, whatever that is. We're not getting into that right now. And they give way for the ability for God, who is simply one, to manifest himself, you know, as a world of multiplicity, as a variety of different colors, as a variety of different experiences, different tastes, different flavors, different appearances. It's like you take one light, and you put in front of it a sheet that has different circles of different colored lenses. If you're standing on the other side of that sheet, covering the light, you're going to see tons of different lights, all in different colors. But really the source of that light and the actual light itself is just one beam of light in one color. So God is that one beam in one color. And the spherot are that lens you're putting on top of it with a variety of colors, so that our world ends up being an expression, being a manifestation of a variety of different colors, all being related and coming from that one pure singular light. Okay? Now, with that said, what emerges is that everything we experience in the world, and if you didn't follow all of that, that's okay. The upshot of all of that is the following amazing, mind-blowing point. Everything we encounter in this world is a different color, is a different manifestation of that one light of God. Everything we encounter, whatever it is, all in different ways. And we're not going to talk right now about if that's the case, how could there be evil and how could there be bad? How could people sin? We're not going that direction right now. It's an important topic. But the point is that everything we encounter is just another one of those lights manifesting God's light. And that's what the spheros are. The spheros are the different colors, 10 different colors that are placed on top of that light that give way to this world being a different manifestation to this world. So there's a chart here that I kind of copied from a combination of Ari Kaplan's book, a little bit of random limited self-knowledge that I have, and a book called Spheros by Rabbi Yaakov Haber, which is for counting Spheros HaOmer. He goes through every day what Spherot is. So I want to just talk about very, very quickly the different spheros and what they are in terms of what I'm talking about, of experiencing God, the different manifestations, the different experiences in this world as being different lights and manifestations of God. So the first spheros, it's kind of, there's 11 listed here because it's kind of a question of how to count them. Okay, there's 10, and there's a question of which one do you count. So there's really 11 possibilities, there's only 10, but different countings, okay, we're not getting into that either. But the first potential one, which isn't always counted, but is called Keter. Okay, Keter is crown, that's the very, very top. Okay, and that is the what gives way to the manifestation of will, of people's desires, people's passions, people's wanting to have a purpose. That basic will that drives us, that we've spoken about, the human being as a meaning-seeking being. That is the sphera, what manifests, what gives way to that is the sphera of Keter. Okay, the next one is Chachma. Chachma is holistic thinking. It's that moment the light bulb goes off. It's the moment of inspiration, of seeing the big picture, of not having the recognition of details, not entering into the nitty-gritty, analyzing, critical thing. It's the big picture. It's seeing the whole thing. That moment of inspiration when something hits you and you're just like lit up and you have that connection in that moment. Bina is then when you take that inspiration, that big picture, and you start to break it down. You start to analyze it. You start to enter into the nitty-gritty. You start to have the critical thinking, seeing details and distinctions. Okay, the next one is Das. Dat is knowledge, but not cognitive knowledge. It's knowledge that becomes internalized. Knowledge that's an intimate knowledge. The Torah, when it refers to marital intimacy in the Torah, it refers to it as Dat. Adam Yodea Eschava, in that they were together. That's what Das is when you are able to know something, but on an intimate level, on an emotional level, when you internalize it. Not just that you know it in your mind as an idea, as a rational thought, but when you're able to take that in a way that it becomes part of who you are. It changes your life. It's something that you know emotionally, you know in your kishkas. Chesed is the next one. is love and kindness and giving. It's when you open up. It's to be an extrovert. It's to go out of yourself and to give to others. Gvura is self-control. It's justice. It's midas hadin. It's to be strict. It's to be that parent that says, you know, get to bed. It's to be to be on top of things and to draw boundaries and to have limitations. Tiferet is sort of the balance. It's when things are able to find their harmony together, to find their balance, to hit that sweet spot. Of beauty, of harmonizing things together. Netzach is a moment when you're able to break through, to overcome a barrier. It's the experience of having a victory, of getting through something that you struggled with, and you have that moment where you're able to overcome it and to jump that fence, to get over the wall. That's Netzach. Hod is the experience of, Hod is like Hoda'ah. It's to have thanks, to have gratitude, to sort of be overwhelmed by something, to have that appreciation when something sort of majestic overwhelms you, and you feel sort of almost submissive to it, but in a positive way. That brings you to a place of thanks and gratitude. Yisod is to have connection, is to create relationships, is to have to make relationships that are deep and meaningful, though, to have covenant type of relationships. And lastly, malchut is to have this capacity to receive. And to have reciprocity. And if you think about it, so these are sort of just like very, very basic descriptions, but these, you know, if you think about all the things we just spoke about, that sort of like makes up the entirety of our experience. You know, we sort of just listed, you know, every different type of emotion or experience or thought that we encounter over the course of our day-to-day lives and over the course of being a person. And the point is that each one of these things is a way that when we experience that, when we experience the moment of chachma, of holistic thinking, of that moment of inspiration where the light bulb goes off. In that moment where the light bulb went off, you just encountered a ray of light of Hashem being manifest into this world to you, that you just encountered that. When you hear a lecture of someone analyzing something, and they're breaking it down, and they're putting it on their microscope of a brilliant analysis, and it sounds amazing. That is you encountering a spark of God being manifest into this world through the light, the lens that we call Bina. But that's an experience of God. When you look at a picture of art and you see this amazing, breathtaking work, that is an experience of encountering a spark of the divine's presence in this world. And in all those ways, in all these things, when you see a person who's able to overcome themselves and to be giving and to be charitable, and to be to be selfless, and you see that moment and that beauty of connection between two people. When you're at a wedding and you see the bride and groom, under the chuppah, and it's amazing to watch and to see that connection, and you feel inspired by looking at that sight. That's an experience of God is manifesting into this world through these people, with the sphere that we call Yesod. In different ways, when you see a person overcome a challenge, and a person who is just, you know, not getting it together, and all of a sudden you see them, they pick themselves up together, and you feel an inspiration in that moment, because you see, wow, it's amazing what a person is able to do. That was an encounter with a different spark, with a different ray of light, a different beam that's radiating into our world. And all these things are different experiences of the divine's presence in this world. And by living with that consciousness, that ability to tap into those experiences, not just as ordinary experiences, not just as things that go on in our lives. Yeah, we go to a wedding and we go to work and we hear a lecture and we see a piece of art and we do all these different things. We go on a vacation and we have an amazing, even just getting together with family and feeling that closeness, feeling appreciation. All those things aren't just things that are going on. Those are all ways in which we are encountering the presence of Hashem in this world, in our lives. And it's through those things, not by getting rid of those things, but it's actually through those things that we are able to more deeply appreciate, more deeply experience and develop a relationship with God in our lives. So I think that for the sake of time, I'm actually going to, So I'm going to skip this part. Suggest if anyone can get hold of a Nusach Svar Siddur, there's an amazing tefillah called L'chai Olamim, that we actually all say. I mean, I'll just read it to you without passing it on and going through the whole thing, but we all say on Yom Kippur, L'chai Olamim. And the tefillah, it's a poem. Basically, goes like this. It goes through, in alphabetical order, different characteristics of things in this world. Haderes v'ha'emuna, strength and faithfulness. L'chai olam, they belong to the eternal one. They belong to the divine, to Hashem. Habina v'habrach, understanding and blessing. L'chai olam, they belong to the eternal one, to Hashem. Hagaiva v'hagedula, grandeur and greatness. They belong to the eternal one. Deya v'dibor, knowledge and speech. And it goes through all these different things. Hod v'hadar, majesty and splendor. It goes through all these different things. And so they belong to the eternal one. What does that mean, they belong to the eternal one? What this is saying is that whenever you encounter in your life aderes, you encounter strength, you encounter emuna, you encounter a trustworthy person, you encounter bina, understanding, you encounter bracha, blessing, you encounter any of these things, they are l'chai olamim. They belong to God. They are God manifesting into this world. They are God shining His light, shining His beauty, His presence, His radiance into your life. And when you encounter them, realize that. Bring them to that place. Bring them l'chai olamim. Trace them back. Right? It's like follow the crumb trail, or however the saying goes. Right? Follow it back to its source. When you encounter any of these things, ha'oz v'hanava, might, humility, when you're impressed with someone's humility, trace it back. Realize it's l'chai olamim. It belongs to the eternal one. It's a shining of the light of the eternal one in this world. So that is sort of, I think, the mindset, the consciousness, the place of the frame of reference, the way that we look at the world, the way we look at our lives, not as just these simple day in and day out interactions and experiences and encounters, but that all these things are different ways that we find Hashem in our lives. Yeah.
Isn't it a choice or a conscious decision to look at those things in that way?
100%.
Meaning we have to want to see Hashem in those things as opposed to being obvious that it's Hashem in those
right
situations.
Yeah, so I mean, what I'm saying is I think that without being too simplistic about it, because for sure there's a large element of it which doesn't come naturally, and it takes sort of developing that mindset and that ability to see it in that way. But what I'm suggesting is that I think we also, if we uncover it, well, the sort of the journey that I was trying to take us on is that the point being that if we're able to give space to it, it actually does come very naturally to us. So not in a way that I don't disagree with you. I think they're both true. I think that there is an aspect that it takes developing this type of mindset, but I also want to push back a little bit, and that I actually think that if we create the space for it, if we look inside of ourselves and sort of put that skeptical, more questioning part of our beings and that more, doing well in school type of mindset that we're trained and put into, if we make, if we put that on the side a little bit, these types of experiences are actually very natural. They come very easily to us, or they would at least if we created that type of space. So that's what I'm suggesting. But at the same time, of course, it's a choice and it's something that takes developing. So then the question with all of this.
Okay, so
yeah, please.
So where is the evil in the world? I mean, it's part. It's not. You never see that, but it's there,
mm-hmm.
And it detracts obviously from all these wonderful things.
Yeah. So my answer is that I'm not going to try and answer it. Number one, because I can't, and number two, because it's a totally different steer us way off course. So I want to try.
Does anybody that you know
address this type of thing? Yeah, for sure. There's lots written on it. Okay. Whether or not any of it actually will be make you feel better about it. I don't know, but to be honest, but I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but I mean, I already said that I bought Chef Marinara sauce. So, but yeah, there's endless amounts of literature and, Jewish sources, tons of stuff written on this, and I'm happy to try and suggest a few. Koldo Dido Fake from Rav Soloveitchik is a definite starting point. It's in English. Fate and Destiny. No, it actually is pretty short, and it's pretty accessible. Okay, so then the question, sort of where we have to go with all of this is, so again, that this brings us to where we left off last time. This was sort of a step back to now take a step forward again. Okay, so good. So where does the life of mitzvos and halacha fall into this? How does this come out practically? Let's just go with this. Let's just be artsy, natural type people and be inspired and have these positive types of experiences. Where does this life of detailed halacha and all this stuff come into play? So it all starts with realizing, at least I think, that all this is really, really nice and amazing. But like I said last time, it's easy to talk about, you know, on a Tuesday night together for an hour. But it falls short of the actuality of life on a certain level. It falls short of the actuality of life on a certain level. And someone asked me after the first year, you know, what does religion mean? You know, what does religion mean? I was talking about, you know, sort of a natural pull towards God, and I was clumping that together with religion. What does religion mean? So I don't know an exact definition. I'm not trying to suggest one. But I would suggest that religion is something to do with taking this sort of inspiration, this sort of movement upwards of feeling connected and trying to translate that into some sort of system of life. Maybe, I don't know, this is just a thought, but maybe that's what religion is. Religion is trying to capture that natural inspiration of belief and connection to something beyond the physical world, and trying to capture that and then translate that into some sort of program, some sort of way of making that concrete for life, and making that something that can be part of your daily life, and not just something that you could talk about, you know, once a week for an hour. So the point being that it starts with realizing that if we don't translate this into some sort of system, this type of inspiration will fall short, will not come into fruition fully, will not actualize itself, again, in the reality of practical life. And Rav Soloveitchik formulates this incredibly well. We're going to read a lot of Rav Soloveitchik tonight. He's going to sort of open up a world for us of what Torah and mitzvot are about. And it starts here on the bottom of page 1, in source 2, in an amazing book called Ubikashtem Misham, and from there you shall seek. Rav Soloveitchik writes the following in A. Judaism also knows, however, and this is after he speaks about everything we just spoke about. Everything I just said is plagiarized from Rav Soloveitchik in my own formulations, but he basically speaks about everything we spoke about, the natural, immediate encounter of relationship with God. And the Rav writes that Judaism also knows, however, that this cosmic encounter, despite its importance, greatness, and force, is insufficient. God reveals himself to his creation, but also eludes it. Now we see him, and yet in a moment he rises above us. Although in moments of inspiration people do hear the sound of the Lord moving about in the garden of being, these moments are ephemeral and quickly pass. And this really actually relates to, I think, a point that George made in the very beginning of the first year, which is that these types of inspirations are so dependent on our moods, on our emotions, on our experiences of what happens to us during the day. And if we had a good day, if we had a bad day, and if things are going well, if things are going poorly, these things really sort of are contingent and dependent on those feelings, those moods, those happenings. And if it's just about this type of inspiration, this type of encounter and experience, so it's fleeting. It's in one day, it's out the next day. You know, it's a roller coaster going up and down, but it doesn't become sustainable. It doesn't become lasting and consistent. So that's the first reason it falls short. So Rav Soloveitchik is pointing out the first reason that it falls short to just talk about these types of, you know, faith and belief and inspirational type of relationship with God is because it's fleeting. It's in one day, out the next. It's a roller coaster up and down. It's very sporadic. It's not consistent, and it's not lasting. That's the first reason. The second thing that the Rav says is in B. He writes, man has discovered something that is separate from the world, but he does not know what it is. And what Rav Soloveitchik here means to say, I think, is that, yeah, we encounter God, we encounter this thing which makes us believe that there's something beyond the world, but still, what is it? All we have from this type of encounter, this type of experience, this type of inspiration, is the realization that there's something more. But we still don't know what it is. We've just realized that there's something there. But how do we come to know what it means to actually be in a relationship with that being? How do we know what that being actually is? So this natural type of faith falls short, number one, because it's fleeting, and number two, because it shouldn't fully satiate us, because we still don't know what it actually is. We just know that it exists, but what is it? And the Rambam writes this, actually, in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah. If you look at source 3, you could look along in English or follow as I read in Hebrew. What is the path to attaining, to coming to love and fear God? So the Rambam says, "B'sha'a sheyizbonin ha'adam b'masav u'beruav haniflaim." When a person sees and contemplates, doesn't just see, but you actually are conscious. You take note of it. You actually realize and appreciate God's creations and God, the wonders of the world that God has created. Haniflaim ha'gedolim, the overwhelming, amazing wonders of the world. The year, meaning the natural pull towards faith. The year mehen chachmas, and you see God's brilliance in it. She'ein la'erech v'lokeitz, that's endlessly brilliant, infinitely brilliant. Miyad hu ohev u'mishabeach u'mefar u'misavet tai. Okay, so you immediately sort of erupt. You burst out in joyous praise of God, of this thirst to realize that God, this amazing being that you just encountered. But then the Rambam says, and what happens from that? U'misavet tava gedola leida Hashem hagadol. And from that you develop a great and passionate desire to now actually know that being. You encountered it, you were inspired by it, but the next step is to actually know what it is, to know who it is, know what it means to be in a relationship with that being. Kamosha Amar David, as David HaMelech, King David said, Sama nafshi l'Elokim, my soul thirsts and yearns for God, l'kel chai, for the living God. So now, good. So where does this leave us? So we have this inspiration, we have this pull, this drive, this desire, this yearning to know God. We're impressed, we're overwhelmed, we want to be in a relationship with this being. We want to consciously, consistently encounter God. So how do we do that? How are we going to get the information we need to do that? It's like you get this amazing, amazing new, you know, phone or computer or something like that. So usually they're actually pretty easy to figure out. I guess it depends what, you know, what generation, but you know, sometimes they're easy to figure out. But you know, let's say it wasn't so easy to figure out. You don't know how to get it started. So you need an instruction manual. You need something to help you figure out what to do with it. So we just got this amazing encounter. We just fell into this amazing relationship with this being, with God, with the divine. Through all the different encounters, through the beauty, through the art, through the genius, through the humility, through the charity, through the goodness, through the selflessness, all these things that we encounter in our lives in this world, and we're brought to this appreciation of this being. But now, how do we actually get to know that being? How do we actually get to be in a relationship with that being? And says the Rav, in Source 4, this is the crisis point where you feel you want to be there. You have this thirst, this driving thirst, this craving, but you don't know what to do with it. That's the crisis point. And what happens? And here God reveals himself from above nature, from beyond the world, bounded by time and space. That is what happened when Hashem gave us the Torah. The Torah is the response to our crisis point of yearning, of encountering that being, of wanting to be close to that being, but not knowing who it is, not really knowing anything about it, other than being inspired by it, and being inspired to want to be with it, but not knowing who it is. God responds to that thirst by revealing himself from above time and space through revelation. And this is the second step in the sort of reciprocal relationship that we have with God. It started from a place, as the Rav calls it, and as we have been calling it, it starts from a place of a natural faith. And then that natural faith, which is our step towards God, is responded to by a revelation of God saying, here I am. Here is how you can know me. Here is how you can love me. Here is how you can be close to me. Here is how we can actually be in a relationship. The Sfarim talk about Shavuos, Matan Torah, Hashem giving us the Torah, as the wedding, as we spoke about this on Sukkot, for whoever was there or remembers, that the three stages of the three holidays during the year are the three stages of developing a relationship, a marriage with God. Pesach is that moment, the first date, the falling in love, the moment of wow, this is an amazing person, an amazing being that I want to be in love with, I want to be in a relationship with. And then Shavuos is the chuppah, is when Hashem brings us under his wing, Hashem brings us in, and says, now we're going to be connected, because here's the Torah, here's how you can actually be in a relationship with me. And then Sukkot is when we go into the sukkah, we go into our yichud room together with Hashem, and we celebrate in the yichud room. And that's the Torah, though. The Torah is Hashem saying, you're coming to me, and I'm taking a step to you now. I'm creating this reciprocal relationship, where we can both know each other, and here's the Torah, here's how you know me. And how that works is built on the natural faith. It's not to uproot or replace the natural faith. It's to build on the natural faith and to be able to capture the natural moments and to take them a step further. So I want to look at this from a few different angles. And the first is we're going to go sort of in ascending order of difficulty. So I'm going to start with the sort of the low-hanging fruits, which will be sort of easier for me to hopefully make the pitch for. And then at the end, I'm going to be, hopefully I'll make a suggestion that actually is compelling and speaks to you, but sort of going to build up towards this. So the first one is what the Rav speaks about in A here, in 4A, when I titled Capturing the Moment, that what halacha comes to do, first and foremost, what halacha comes to do is it comes to give us the ability that in that moment when we've encountered God, in any of the myriad of ways that we spoke about, any of the variety of different lights, the different radiances, the different beauties of tasting God in this world, of being inspired, of having that upward moment of inspiration, that surge, being able to capture the moment and harness it and actually sink into it and appreciate it and make it real and internalize it. And the Rav writes in 4a here, the halacha approves of this confrontation between God and man within the world. We are commanded by the halacha to utter a benediction, a prayer, a blessing, a bracha, over every cosmic phenomenon, over the, and now the Rav is just going to use his sort of really over-the-top, amazing poetic language, over the afterglow of the fiery sunset and the purple of the sunrise trickling along the mountaintops, over the rising moon sprinkling its pale light, over the stars in their courses and the comets leaping from clear space, over the sight of the rainbow in the clouds, over the trees and sweet-smelling exquisite flowers, over the murmur of the ocean and the rushing of the surf, upon eating water and breaking bread, maybe I should say, the fruits of the trees and the crops of the field, over the healthy body, created wisdom, with its muscles and nerves, over the ability to move and stand erect. What does the benediction attest to, the bracha attest to, if not for the strange fact that in spite of the psychological law, that habit and custom dull the subtleties of feeling, dim the alertness of the intellect, and extinguish the flame of ecstasy, the Jew is enthusiastic about each and every phenomenon. For the Jew, there is no such thing as routine. Everything is a wondrous miracle. So the first goal of halacha is to give us the ability to go through something, go through life, which can become a habit, can become routine, can become mundane, and be able to, as much as possible, of course it doesn't work every time, but as much as possible, be able to experience the grandeur, the what should be like just an overwhelming, this is crazy, amazing, I can't believe this is true moment, but it becomes so habitual. But halacha is coming to try and give us the ability to experience everything with enthusiasm, to experience everything as a miracle, to experience everything as amazing. Every time you have the opportunity to be with family, every time you have the opportunity to be with friends, every time you have the opportunity to hear something, to listen to music. I can't believe I haven't mentioned music as an example of anything. For me, music is the most transcending thing that I'm able to tap into experience the divine. To experience all these things and capture the moment and sink into the moment. To be in the present. Nowadays in 2015, the biggest thing is to be present. It's mindfulness, right? Mindfulness. Halacha has for eternity understood the greatness of mindfulness. Every time you make a bracha, it's a meditation. It's a mindfulness meditation. That's what it is. That's what the Rav is saying here. It's trying to capture the moment and bring you into the present. One of the great Chabad Rebbes said that the word for Hashem, Yud Kei, Vav and Kei, Yud and Hei, Vav and Hei, is actually made up of the word hoveh, which means present, and yud. Yud is always God. It's the smallest point of any physicality. So it's God. Present, God's name means the ability to bring God into the present. To have the yud in the hoveh, that makes up God's name. That makes up God. Is the ability to connect to where you are right now and to appreciate that and tap into that. So all the different things we spoke about through the spheres, the different lights, the different tastes, the different flavors of the world that we encounter, that we experience, that we tap into that radiance of God, in all those things, to sink into it, to be present, to bring that yud, that godliness, into the hova, into the present moment, and to be mindful, and to make a bracha, and to do that right there, and appreciate it, and sink into it, and capture the moment. So that's the first sort of the most basic goal. That's the easy one for me to pitch. That's the first basic goal of halacha and of mitzvos. Yeah, please.
what we're talking about, it seems like such a deep, rich, colorful experience. And it's probably because I haven't learned it yet. But in my limited experience with halacha, there doesn't seem to be an importance placed on the experience as much as it is in doing a certain line, like a certain process. Really, you know, like the process is to adhere to,
mm-hmm.
but the rich experience that may or should be infused in the process doesn't always seem to be one that we hold of such high importance.
Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah,
maybe
I mean,
you're learning the wrong
thing. No, meaning it's, I mean, that's the $1 million question. You're 100% right, but at the same time, it's a very tricky question to address, because the honest answer in my mind is that it is all there in halacha, and
we're just doing it wrong.
I'm gonna go with that. I'm not gonna say it myself. it's a very difficult thing, because I believe that it is all there if we have the right mindset for it. I believe that I'm going to get to it at the end. I'm going to get to where this isn't true and where we have to also make space for something else and the more difficult experiences with halacha. I'm going to address that. But in terms of the bigger picture of the fact that I do think this is true, I think that we needed to develop that mindset, which allows for halacha to express itself, sort of fully. Meaning, like just for example, the person we're reading right now, Rav Soloveitchik, was, you know, the halachist of all time. Meaning he was, you know, Ish HaHalacha. He wrote a book called Halachic Man. You know, he was about the nitty-gritty of halacha. He was an authentically true halachic person. You know, this isn't apologetics to halacha. He was an authentically halachic person. But this is what he experienced in halacha. You know, he writes at the beginning of all his books, I'm not telling you something that is necessarily objectively true. I'm telling you my personal experience. Right. And this is what he experienced in halacha. So it does exist in halacha. It's we have to, I think, build in ourselves that mindset and build. You know, it's very difficult. It's challenging, but I think it is all there. But it's a tricky thing. That's the $1 million question. Yeah.
I also feel like, you know, the you're talking about the belief in God being, you know, sort of brought in more strongly with the use or the doing of halacha, of mitzvot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a sort of a reverse to that as well, which is that, you know, even if there isn't that belief in God, that the doing of the halacha eventually brings you to that point.
100%. I agree with that. I agree with that very wholeheartedly. That's actually something that I feel very, I really agree with that. I'm excited to agree with you. I really, it's something that's something that I've spent a lot of time to develop the case for that exact approach, that's actually what Na'aseh V'Nishma means. Meaning we don't have to know why before we do it, not because the why is not important, but because you can only know why once you've tasted the experience itself. You can't explain to someone who's never listened to music in their life how amazing music is without playing for them the music. You can't explain to someone how energetic, how adrenaline pumping, how thrilling it is to be at a professional sports game, you know, at the end of the season, the finals, the playoffs, whatever it is, how amazing it is if they've never been able to actually be there and experience it. So part of it is the ability to actually experience it and then come to understand what it is that's going on. So I agree with that 100%. It's a different sort of approach that I'm not trying to look at so much right now, but I, yeah.
It would seem that this concept fits more for the essays than the los essays.
Okay, very good. So I want to get to the los essays right now or in a minute. So yeah, 100%, very good. So
I just want to say one real quick that I think is really interesting, and not to belabor on this, but he uses the word confrontation right at the beginning, and he could have used many other words like relationship between God and man. So
yeah,
he doesn't. There's nothing.
I know it's right. It's actually really interesting because I noticed that I was just reading it right now. I didn't notice that when I was writing it up, but. Mm-hmm. But in this book, he's very much pitching the relationship mode of man and God, not so much confrontation. So it's actually pretty interesting that here he specifically uses confrontation. So Tzarach Iyam. We have to look into it. But yeah.
But it doesn't have to be. I mean,
it doesn't have to be a negative.
Right. I mean, you're confronting. Right, you're confronting.
But usually it has a little bit of a more.
Right. When I first looked at it. But yeah. And then the last sentence is, I think, with Dope and what Jeff is saying, for the Jew, there's no such thing as routine. Well, everything we do is so routine.
Right. So he's clearly being.
But everything is wonder, and we don't think of it. Right. It should be. Everything is a wonder.
So he's definitely talking on an idealistic level right now. He knows that, you know, or at least I hope he knew, that you know, this isn't the reality of day-to-day life. But he's trying to give us what halacha is striving for, what it's aimed at giving us. Of course, it's not going to be like this day in, day out, and I want to get to that, of how it's not actually like that day in, day out, in a little bit. But yeah, for sure. So, one second. Okay, so let's try and move a drop quickly. So in B, I want to move to another level of what it means that the mitzvos are meant as giving us a relationship with God. In 4B, the Rav writes the following, and then we'll explain. The revelation in prophecy is God revealing himself to human beings, not in order to take them out of the world, but to reform and elevate it. Physiological drives are sanctified through the moral commandments, which are not intended to subdue this world, but rather to place upon it the crown of royalty. The animalistic behavior of eating has been refined by the halacha and transformed into a religious ritual and an elevated moral act. Neither Greek philosophy nor Christianity grasped the moral and metaphysical aspects of sexual intercourse. Only the halacha gives this act a solid basis in religious life. The commandment to be fruitful and multiply is the first one in the Torah. Marital life is pure and blessed. The Rav here is saying that halacha is not intended to sort of squash us, to make things claustrophobic, to suffocate us. Halacha is aimed at elevating everything we do, at refining, at redeeming the world. Now, how does it do this? It does this by way of harnessing the physical drives, the physical world that we are made up of, and trying to take that physical world, why this is what God created the world to be is a whole different discussion, but what it's trying to do is take the power, the energy, the muscle of the physical world, and take that and raise it up, and refine it, elevate it, and show how even in that, God is present, and if you refine it, you're bringing that world that seems to be distant from God, and you're bringing that up to a more transcendent, to a more holy, a more redeemed place. And the way that halacha does that, and this speaks to whoever just asked about the prohibitions, the way halacha does that, and this is going to be a total 180, if you've never thought about this before, the way halacha is able or attempts to transform the mundane into the holy is through putting restrictions on things, is by making things have contexts where they can actually be meaningful. If you just say, you know, eat whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. So now, it's very difficult to argue, if you're going to be honest with yourself, that eating is a holy act, because it's just total sort of hefkerus, as we would say. It's totally just open. It's haphazard. It's just, you know, it's do what you want. You know, it'd be hard if you're going to be honest with yourself to argue that when you eat, you're experiencing and you're trying, making an attempt to do something meaningful. You're just doing what the pleasure is. You're engaging in pleasure, indulging in pleasure. Halacha places restrictions on things to create a way in which when you then engage positively in something in the proper context, it's done in a context which allows it to actually be intentional and meaningful. And not just because this is what the pleasure seeks. And this is what the Rav writes about in a different book called Family Redeemed. He writes in source 5 on page 3. And we're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes. So just bear with me. He writes, Judaism's philosophy of carnal existence is an optimistic one. It foresees its undreamed of progress and improvement. He's saying the physical world, halacha sees, looks at the human being, the physical human being, with all its drives and all its yearnings and cravings for pleasure. And we all have part of ourselves that are negative and drawn towards selfishness and towards just totally giving into pleasure and doing different not necessarily the greatest things. But it looks at us, halacha, from an optimistic point of view. It looks at us, it foresees its undreamed of progress and improvement. All it requires of man is to redeem himself, body and soul, by employing the knowledge and technique available to him, and by fashioning a great world out of hilic matter, material, formless matter. If you think I know what every word here means, I don't. The world of man is not denied and destroyed by halacha, but renewed and rehabilitated in pain. This is the really key sentence. The world of man is not denied and destroyed by halacha, but renewed and rehabilitated in pain. It's through constrictions, through limiting ourselves, that we're able to renew our actual physical drives. Not reject the physical drives, but renew those physical drives in a more intentional, meaningful, substantial, substantive way. A new license to life, this worldliness and happiness, is obtained through the anguish of withdrawal, through the throes of giving up and sacrifice. And we detest unruly, chaotic, boundless, and unsatiated desire, which knows no limits, one which is hedone intoxicated, and which desires only to enjoy, no matter what or how. That is what halacha is trying to do. Now, I'm sort of out of time, so there's a lot more to say on this, but I'll let you sort of process it on your own and think about how this plays into your life, into your halachic experience, and sort of develop a new lens for yourself to try and maybe process halacha a little bit anew. I just want to add with one story with it, which was going to address Dov's point, and then one I think really, really crucial thought that I think you have to have in mind for this entire type of approach. So the story is that there's the story told. Chassidim like to tell this story because it makes the misnagdim, the people who oppose Chassidus, look really bad. So I'm not so into the caricature of the misnagdim part of it, but the story about Chassidim is awesome. So I'm just going to tell it, and let's just be favorable to the to understand a little bit more subtly than this story makes it out to be the other side of the story. But the story goes that there was this great Lithuanian misnagdim of the people who were opposed to Chassidim. Okay, so the great misnagdish rabbi who got, I guess, converted on some level to Chassidus. And he went to Kutsk. Okay, Kutsk Rebbe was one of the great Chassidish rebbes. And he went to Kutsk, and it was Yom Kippur. He decided, I'm going to go to Kutsk for Yom Kippur. And it's Yom Kippur. They have a short little break. Before, it'd been awesome if this would have happened to us in Tash, you know, or my initiation. So there's a short little break before Ne'ilah, and before the climax of the day. It's such a passionate, intense, serious day. It's everyone's transcendent, elated, out of this world experience. Right before Ne'ilah, right before the highest point of the highest day, and they're taking a little break. And this rabbi, this sort of ex misnagdish rabbi, is sitting there, and the Hasidim come over to him with a bottle of whiskey and a shot glass, and they say, you know, new, how you doing? How you holding up? He's like, great. And they're like, you know, I'm sure you're probably a little bit tired. You know, before Ne'ilah, you could probably use a shot. You know, you could probably use a little bit, give you some chis, give you some strength, give you an extra boost before Ne'ilah. You know, Yom Kippur, we fast, so he's tired. It's the end of a long day. So he looks at me. How are you crazy? The Mishnah Brura. The Mishnah Brura says you can't drink on Yom Kippur. You can't eat on Yom Kippur. How could you possibly say that I should drink on Yom Kippur? You know, the Mishnah Brura is one of the really late halachic codifiers. And the Chassidim say, I know, but you know, it's going to give you so much more kavana. Your ne'ilah is going to be so much stronger. It's worth it. It's worth it for you to take this drink because it's going to give you so much more strength. And he says, are you crazy? The Shulchan Aruch was a little bit before the Mishnah Berurah. The Shulchan Aruch writes clearly, it's usur, it's prohibited to drink and eat and drink in Yom Kippur. And he said, I know, but it's going to give you a little bit more strength. And he says, what are you talking about? The Gemara is even before the Shulchan. The Gemara says you can't eat and drink in Yom Kippur. And he says, and they say, I know, but it's going to give you a little more strength. He says, the Mishnah is even before the Gemara. The Mishnah says you can't eat and drink. And they say, I know, but it's going to give you more strength. He says, I don't understand. The Pasuk, it's a Pasuk. It says in the Torah, it's a verse in the Bible. You can't eat and drink. They say, I know, but it's going to give you more strength. And he says, Hashem said you can't eat and drink in Yom Kippur. And they say, that's all we cared about. That's what we wanted to happen. We never wanted you to drink in Yom Kippur. But we wanted you to stop thinking it was the Mishnah Berurah who said it. We didn't want you to think it was the Shulchan Aruch who said it. We didn't want you to think it was the Gemara, the Mishnah, or the Pasuk. Hashem said you shouldn't eat and drink Yom Kippur. You're not eating and drinking Yom Kippur is part of your relationship with God. Not with the book. Not with the do's and don'ts. Not with the burden. It's part of your experience of Hashem's voice. Of the revelation of Hashem responding to our step of this natural step of faith towards Hashem. And Hashem reveals His will, His way that we can be close to Him, to us through the Torah. Because that's what we wanted you to understand. And the last point that I wanted to just say, because I think it's really crucial, I apologize for going a bit over time tonight, but it's the last one, so it's hard to keep it all wrapped up. So I mean, I had a whole, you know, just take home now. This is the last point I wanted to make, which I think is really crucial. We all know, if we're being realistic about anything I said tonight, that this is not how we experience halacha all the time. My suggestion, my offering to you with all of this is that trying to internalize this, trying to build this, and you can get tastes of this. I believe I've experienced amazing experiences of God and of elation and of amazing, amazing meaning and transformative life, happiness, and meaning through experiencing the Torah in this way. And I do believe that everyone can tap into that to some level. But we all know that it's not going to be a constant. And we're going to have times where things are really, really annoying. We're not going to understand a lot of the details of halacha. Sometimes it's going to seem like it doesn't fit into this type of inspirational picture. It's going to seem like it's so burdensome. It's so annoying. That bag that we're schlepping is so heavy. And it doesn't make any sense. And why is this halacha? And who cares about the pots and pans that we use for? Who cares about all that stuff? It has nothing to do with this. And one of the most key things to remember in that context specifically is that that's all still part of the relationship. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit nervous my in-laws are here, but I'm married, and I don't understand every single thing my wife always wants. It's not always that moment of inspiration. It's not always that moment of blissful connection. The day in and day out of any relationship that you want to be meaning, that you want to be lasting, is going to consist of moments of doing things that you don't want to do. But they matter to the other party in the relationship. Doing things that you don't understand, pushing yourself, forcing yourself to be present, to be mindful in those moments where it's not necessarily even meaningful at all, where it doesn't make any sense. But that's crucial to any relationship to be meaningful, to be lasting. And that's very true with this relationship as well. And I think from my experience, that's how I try and frame when I often don't understand a lot of things in Judaism. I have tons of questions and tons of things that really actually bother me sometimes, and things that I don't get, and things that really just don't fit into this framework of this really beautiful picture of Judaism. But my mindset, I don't give up on them, I still try to uncover more meaning, but my mindset in that moment is, yes, but this is part of being in a relationship, to be present even when you don't understand it, and that transforms even the meaningless into being somewhat meaningful, because they're part of a relationship, part of an encounter, part of an ongoing experience. Okay, so I apologize for going over. We're going to continue next time, not with this series, as a new sort of experiential hands-on workshop of something I'm really excited about, of transforming your tefillah experience through the use of imagination. So it's going to be a little bit hands-on, experiential meditation next Tuesday night. So stay tuned for details. If anybody is interested